installment in the section of this topic of relationships, which we're discussing this year, on man, woman, husband, wife, and we'll be discussing today a little bit more about, we spoke about it the last year, how men and women differ fundamentally, not only based on their biology and their anatomy, but also on who they are. The rabbis are very understanding of differences which exist between men and women. One of the examples that's given is emotional sensitivity. Generally speaking, women are simply more emotionally sensitive than men. Noshim Rachmani are saying. Chazal say that an older woman will dance to music with younger women as well. The very word rachamim, which means mercy, has to do with the word recha, which means womb. For this reason, as we mentioned in the previous year, one has to be extremely careful in dealing with a woman, not to lead her to tears. Mitoch shedim asa metzuya ona asa krova. Because she's more likely to cry, you can tease her and hurt her feelings more easily than you can those of a man. Indeed, men can also be hurt emotionally, but women somehow are more given to this. Now, it's interesting. We have to understand, and this is all based on Rabbi Feldman Sefer, River, the Kettle, and the Bird, that one shouldn't think that a woman is crying when she feels less pain than a man. She's some kind of a sissy, as some would like to have it. The other way around. Anyone who knows that women are able to take pain more than men. As one of my friend's mothers once said, if men had to deliver babies, no one would ever be born. So we are in awe of the ability of women to be able to take difficult pain. But she feels worse when she feels a measure of emotional abuse than a man feels. So the man says to himself, why is she crying? If someone would say this to me, I wouldn't cry. The answer is because you don't feel it as much. No. I'll just give an example. Some women, I guess men too, from a different time and place, are able to hold on to a hot glass of tea with their bare hands. Whereas I would drop it in an instant. I can't take it. Too hot for me. Doesn't mean I'm a sissy. It means my body, the way it's been programmed, this is too hot for me. Whereas women who maybe deal more in the kitchen and they deal with hot pots and not they're used to it more. So it's a different ability to withstand it. Yes, there are men who will be brought to tears by what we'll call emotional abuse, but only on a much higher level. The threshold of pain is simply higher for men in this respect. When we say that a woman is sensitive, it's not a shortcoming. It's simply a reality. It's a reality. And therefore, no man should ever make light of his wife's tears. And certainly no man should ever be silly enough to try to bring her to tears. That's number one. Number two. Men and women are different in the way they think about things, in the way they respond to different types of knowledge. Again, this is based upon secular sources. It's claimed that men have a better, what's called spatial relations, are able to follow a map better. Some women have problems following the map. Which way? This way, this way, this way. Can give them directions. It's a reality. There's nothing to be ashamed of. That's just a reality. When it comes to verbal skills, women are superior. There's no question about it. The Gemara tells us that women are more given to speaking, and they're better at it. Again, making generalizations. We're not talking about the specifics. Not only that. there's a lot of research, and I mentioned this a little bit last time, that in certain subjects, men have been demonstrated to be superior, generally speaking, in their accomplishment, such as math and abstract science. It's a reality. It's a reality. So, what's it based upon? After citing a number of sources that he thinks are not correct, Rabbi Feldman Shlita quotes a Gemara in Masechta Yuma, which he says he thinks not based on a difference in, or a disparity in intelligence, but rather in motivation. Chazal say, "Ein adam lomed al b'makom shalibo chafetz." People study and excel in areas where they want to be involved. Now, what's the problem with this abstract mathematics and science? It's very abstract. Women, generally speaking, are much more what we call in our language tachlis oriented. Give me tachlis. I want to know, how do I do this? How do I do that? How does it get done? Things which are purely theoretical don't, women aren't so interested in as a general principle. Again, many exceptions. Math is very far removed from real life. Men, they're more into these things. And this is applies certainly to the study of Talmud, as we mentioned last time. Although the Talmud is a source for all halacha l'maisa, it's only after a lot of study, of years and years of study, with matters which are practical and non-practical, do you learn the methodology and the theory. Someone who starts learning l'maisa when he's 15, when he first starts studying the Talmud, it's too early. You have to wait, presumably about 5 years, if you ask me. A person studies Talmud for 5 years until he's 20, approximately. We start the Gemara a little bit earlier, but until then he's mastered the methodology of how to open a Gemara and get through a Tosfos. Then he's ready to study the same Gemara with a more practical orientation. And this could explain to us why women are exempt from the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. It's not the explanation that I gave you in name of Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe said that she's potter because she's too busy taking care of her family, and the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is all-encompassing. Just as according to Rav Moshe, for the same reason she's potter from Zman Grama, because it's time-dependent. Rabbi Feldman suggests a different possibility. Again, since she doesn't have a natural motivation for theoretical study, which is necessary ultimately to understand things properly, so she may not understand the Torah appropriately, as Rambam says. Again, not because she has any less intellectual ability, but she lacks, in Rav Feldman's words, the natural bent for theoretical abstractions. And therefore, since she may not get to the right answer at the end of the day, the Torah exempted her from Talmud Torah, and she is supposed to pick up the practical stuff, which she is obligated to study. I repeat, a woman is obligated to study halacha l'maisa, as it's found in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, in Yerodea, but on a more practical basis, without all the theoretical underpinnings. This is why sometimes men and women get involved in unproductive argumentation. Because the man is approaching the issue from his own perspective. He's trying to convince his wife of the logic of his argument. But as we mentioned last time, it's like a Martian argument with someone from Venus. What are you giving me so logical for? She intuits that her position is correct. It's based on intuition, on emotion, and all of his logic is worthless. So simply, they're just like boats passing in the night. There's no real communication. The Gemara we mentioned last time also says that a man should follow whatever his wife says in mili de alma, or mili de besa, because they have better skills in real world situations. And related to this, women are given what we call bina yisera, the famous women's intuition that we talk about. They are better than men at seeing things in a practical way. And that's why the Gemara tells us that women understand guests better than men. I can say in my house it's certainly true. I miss certain things. But she has a much more a deeper understanding on a practical level of who is who and what is what. And they're just different. And there's no superiority or inferiority, just different. And I know that some feminists or egalitarianists are very much opposed to any of these distinctions. Okay, I'm just telling you but based upon not just Torah perspective, it's even based on secular perspective in analyzing these things. And now we're going to move to the text you have in front of you about Noshim Daton Kalos. What does that mean? We know that women have a Bina Yisera. So what could it possibly mean that Noshim Daton Kalos? Let's pick up on page 64. So what is Das? And what does it mean that women have it in a lighter form? I'm giving you what Rabbi, it's interesting, it's a Parsha Shavua. What's Parsha Shavua? By Avidu Mitzrayim, it's B'nei Yisrael, Beforech. Avodas Perech. Chazal teaches us, what does Avodas Perech mean? He was so smart, this power, that bum. He gave men women's work, and women men's work. He knew that they could not succeed. Okay? He writes over here, women have a capacity to move from one activity or idea to another with more ease than men. Datan Kalos means their das is lighter, can easily move from one place to the other. Men are focused upon, involved in a single specific idea or activity which interests them. I recently had a conversation with a relative of mine, and we're trying to help some different relative, and this woman said to me, you know, that's how men are. She had no idea I'm saying a shiur on this. That's how men are. They can only focus on this. So when she had a certain favor was done by a certain person, she said, you know, I need another favor. Let's worry about this now. I can't even think about it until later on. That's, she said, that's how men are. Whereas women, while they're helping A, can also think about helping B, because they're able to think beyond what's right in front of them. Okay? So Das, he says, is concentration and involvement. And a woman, Dat and Kalos, mean that Das can move more easily from one area of concentration to another. As a lighter object can be moved more easily than a heavy one. Quote to Gemara. The Gemara says, Tiltule de Gavra, Kosha mid Itisa. If people move from one place to the other, it's harder for a man than for a woman. As we said before, women are more mobile. They can move more easily, more readily. For a man to move around is much more difficult. Now, he's making a suggestion, a speculation. Why were women given this particular type of Datan Kalos? He suggests, I think correctly, because to facilitate the building and nurturing of the home and family, to raise children and maintain a home, is a multifaceted work. You require great mental and emotional agility. What a nice word. It says Datan Kalos. So therefore, there's different interruptions. You can juggle many things. You heard the word juggle before. Oh, she's juggling a job and a husband and children and a house. She's juggling. Now, men are not such good jugglers. It just doesn't work. She can juggle the various obligations simultaneously. That's how women are able to do it. Men can be driven to near madness by constant interruptions, next page 65, distractions, and incompleted work of a woman's normal routine. Any man who ever experienced taking over the duties of the household for a day can testify to this. I can testify. But look at this great story. I love this story. I know of a man who decided to offer his services to his wife one Erev Shabbos, announcing that he was ready to perform any duty she requested. Okay, very, very noble, right? During the following hour, he was asked to, hold the baby, put down the baby to turn off the stove, bring the mop, turn on the stove, pick up the baby, turn off the stove, put away the baby, and start peeling potatoes. Stop peeling potatoes to calm the baby's crying. Start peeling again. Empty the garbage pail, which has overflowed with peelings. Put down the pail to pick up the baby who had begun crying. Clean up the mess caused by his inadvertent overturning of the pail as he picked the baby up. Turn on the stove again until he was close to mental collapse. Right? He finally decided he could take it no longer, and in an obviously tense voice told his wife that he was leaving the house. His wife could not understand why he was suddenly leaving when she needed him most, and why he had become so upset about having to help her for just an hour. 1 hour. She does this the whole week. all the men and women are smiling in the room. They can, well, you all understand how true this is. This is the truth. This is the truth. And I quote this week's parsha. This explains why Paro ordered his male slaves to women's labor and females to be men. A scheme devised to inflict maximum torture. They just couldn't do it. Okay, this is, again, Parshat Shavua. Right to the point. Now, we're going to turn to the next page. Women can adjust more readily. For example, he says, if a man is interrupted by a telephone call after having begun a certain task, he'll be more likely than a woman to return to it after the call. His, quote, heavy das does not permit him to sever his attachment to his original activity even after he becomes involved with the second occupation. But a woman, once she gets involved in a new activity, is more likely to lose track of what she was originally doing. Her lighter das has become detached from the first endeavor and is now concentrated fully upon the second. It's called hesech das, removal of das. That's what it means. That's what it means. Now, the next sentence. Look at this now. This is a general observation, almost a cliche, that women have more difficulty with promptness than men. I always, whenever people say, my wife is always late, my response is the same. Women are potter for mitzvah aseh, she's man grama. So to be on time is man grama, she's potter. Don't complain. This may be because of their lighter das. They may have scheduled their day a certain way, but because they are easily drawn to fresh activities, they may deviate from their schedule. Lateness, especially on Erev Shabbos, is often a source of marital strife. The man has to say to his woman, you know, remind her nicely to light the candles, etc. If they'd recognize that lateness would be rare or stem from the special kind of das, they might react more calmly. Let me give a piece of personal advice. Personal advice. Let's say, for argument's sake, they have to go to a wedding. They're going to a bar mitzvah, they're going to a simcha. And the man wants to try to be on time, and he's waiting for his wife, and she's not ready. It's happened to everybody, it's happened to every couple in this room, without a question. So what do you do? Any man who waits for his wife impatiently is asking for a disaster. A disaster. He's like blowing up more and more and more and more. He's blowing up. This is what you should do. Take your Chumash and your Rashi, the Parsha Shavua, and start, you know, the Chiyuv to read Shnayim Mikra Vechatak. Doesn't require so much concentration. Sit there, you're sitting with your jacket, and your tie, you're ready to go, and just take and read the Parsha. You know, you read the Parsha, and that's it. You get involved in the Parsha, and tell your wife, okay, ready to go. Close the Chumash, and you're gone. This is the way to do it. By the way, I have the same advice to people who have to wait on lines. If you have to wait on lines, you can go mad. Just take a little Chumash with you, and a Tillim, whatever you want to take. Tillim is also the same thing. And this way you will not be driven to distraction, not by the lines and wherever you have to be, or by the waiting in your own house. I seriously feel that this is a very important piece of advice, because otherwise people get very upset, and for no reason.
You finish the parsha the third time.
Go on to the next parsha. I give you a heter to read the Marva Sedra for the next week. I told the story in the car. I just came back from Eretz Yisrael. I was driving somewhere, I reminded people in my car, I think it was my son was in the car, Simcha, that we were bypassing a certain famous intersection called Masmiya. Those who know the Kerem B'Yavne, the way to Be'er Sheva, it's a famous junction. And there's a new road which he hadn't seen, and he's been out of there for 5 years, that bypassed it. I said, that Masmiya, I went to spend 8 hours, something, a tremendous amount of hours there. Long before they had cell phones, back in 1966, we made up to meet in a certain junction. We came from Yerushalayim. It's a friend who was supposed to pick us up from Tel Aviv area to go down to the Negev with some kind of a tiyul with jeeps. I was like, when we were young, Yavna students. So we got there on time. No sign of anybody. No phones, no cell phones, nothing. All I had with me was one sefer. It was a Chumash and Rashi and Bereishis. That's all I had. I had nothing else. Nothing. I wasn't expected to be learning. I was going on a teal. Well, everyone else is going nuts, all my friends. I decided, you know what? I'll try to trick myself. I was a young kid. But I said, you know, this trick works. I started the Chumash with Rashi. And I gave myself a heter to go ahead. I finished the entire Chumash of Bereishis. I think it was Sunday after Parshas Bereishis. I think I did all the other 11 Parshas with all the Chumash, with all the Rashi. And then who knows how many times they said, oh, we couldn't rent the jeeps. They wouldn't let us rent it. We were too young. You know, and they came 8 hours later. So who knows how many hours late. That's all. You have to have something with you, a tilim, a chumash, at all times, not to get driven to distraction by delays. So if a man has a more punctual tendency and a woman often comes a little bit late, okay, just take out a sefer and sit there. That's all. Don't get upset. You sit there with your coat on. Don't ever put your coat on. It's dangerous. Put your coat, so you can take another second to put a coat on later on. Sit there, and this way you'll be have a much more peaceful home. Speaking of home, this is this is extraordinarily important. While a man, especially during the first years of his marriage, looks at his home as a dormitory, mamish, it's a dorm. Okay? So you used to have some male roommate or two, now it's a female roommate, but it's a dorm. All right, you have to, it's a dorm. A woman sees it as an extension of herself. It represents her personhood. Of course, Chaim Shmulevitz. That the enjoyment he used to get from the compliments of on his shiurim, all right, taught him to be careful to compliment his wife on her accomplishments in the home. His wife's Shabbos meal, used to say, is her equivalent to his shiur. So, you have to compliment her on how good the kugel is, how good the chont is, because that's the same as he likes to be complimented how good the shiur was. That's what he said. Indeed, every aspect of the home, how it is decorated, how it is organized, and what impression it makes, is an expression of his wife as homemaker. It's very, very important that we shouldn't be oblivious to this. Sometimes men are asked by their wife, what should I do? Should I put the picture here? Put the picture there. So put the couch here and the piano there, or the couch there and the piano here? And the man inside feels, do whatever you want. I couldn't care less. That's what he feels inside. And ultimately, he has to defer to her anyway, mita debesa. But if you do that, it's in a certain sense demeaning. You're not giving her the respect that she deserves for something which is so important to her. So express an interest. Even if you're just sort of making believe. But I think the couch should be here and the piano should be there. 50% chance at least she'll say the other way around. But it doesn't matter. You gave your opinion based on whatever you thought. It means you care about it. The picture should hang here, and this wall, not in that wall. She'll do the other way around. It doesn't matter. You expressed interest in what's so important to her, namely her home. Let's go on. A woman is therefore more sensitive to the appearance of a home than a man is. That's for sure. She suffers greatly if her husband's home is not neat and presentable. Husband, for example, cannot understand why a wife gets so upset because he's left his socks on the floor. Okay, gentlemen, don't leave socks on the floor. Please. To a woman, however, this is nearly the same as if he would have left his socks hanging on the front doorknob, which I hope no one ever does. She sees his sloppiness reflecting on her. And look at this incredible story. This story I've told so many times. I know of a family which was once desperately trying to sell its home. After some time, a buyer finally presented himself. He was leaving town, but the description of the house seemed to make it exactly what he was looking for. He was ready to sign a contract, provided that he can inspect the house within the hour. Catch a plane. Although some $60,000 was at stake, the lady of the house refused him permission to look it over. Can you imagine that? Her reason. She was ashamed to let him see it before she had a chance to straighten up. As a result, the deal fell through. Mind-boggling. I don't know what I would do. If I were the husband, I would go nuts. Want to sell the house. $60,000. This is $1987. That means today, 100 at least. More than that. It's double since then. More. 3 weeks ago, whatever it was. I don't know how to calculate these things anymore. But the bottom line is a tremendous amount of money was lost because she wouldn't let him in. Let him in. What's the big deal? You never see him before. You never see him again. Nope. It wasn't enough time. Even if he would have helped her. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have. $60,000, he's interested. Very few men would react this way. Still, no man has a right to get angry with his wife for such a reaction, since he cannot gauge the degree of humiliation she would experience by showing a house in disarray. Okay? This is very, very, very important. Very important. This is such a critical thing. We have to understand that men and women are just different. And they have to realize this and have to respect it. And it's this difference which makes life so interesting and marriage interesting. But if either one wants a clone, it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. They're different not only in their biology, the difference in their psychology, the difference in their attitudes. And these differences are real, put in place by the Rabbono Shlomo himself. And to be oblivious to it is to be very insensitive. I mentioned this in my drasha this morning. Nosan Eino Velibo. Right? You have to first see. Sometimes men don't treat their wives properly. Not because they're heartless, because they're myopic. They don't see. They don't see that the woman's makeup is different than their own. And therefore, they don't get it. They say, look, I'm not treating her shabbily. I'm treating her the same as I treated my chavrusa or my roommate in the dorm. Exactly. You're blind. You don't see that she's a woman. She has a different way of thinking. And to treat her as you would treat a male friend is simply totally inappropriate. Again, not heartless, but simply blind, not realizing you're inflicting pain on this person. This is why we have to open up our eyes today and see what's going on. And I'm sure that women to men has a similar kind of a problem. Again, this book is written for men, but I'm sure that women sometimes are angry at their husbands, and mistakenly so, because the husband's just different. He doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it. What you get so intuitively, he doesn't get. That's why he's responding the way he's responding. Not a source of anger, just it's the incomprehension. Okay. Now, in this next part of this chapter, which you don't have in front of you, Rav Feldman Shlita goes into the physical differences between women and men and how it impacts on the marriage. He quotes a noted gynecologist. He's a man who did his homework. Every groom should realize that he's marrying three women. I'm to Ben Agesh. Three women. Normal, menstruous, and pregnant. Because once a month, a woman goes through a major change in her metabolism. Are you aware that PMS, premenstrual syndrome, has been used with some success by defense attorneys, even in murder cases? You can't blame this woman for committing this murder. She wasn't herself. She was overcome with PMS, as it's called. Wild. It's a wild idea. And at that point in the cycle, she could become shrill, annoyed, aggressive, impatient, tense. Far from the calm, relaxed woman the husband thought he was marrying. So, the man shouldn't take it as a personal affront. To the contrary, as a hormonal source. Just as she has become physically separated, she's become somewhat emotionally separated. And here's a very serious problem. I've been approached by couples over the years that they can't handle the emotional separation that results from the halachas of Taras HaMishpach. And it almost always goes the same way. That we can't have relations together. I understand that. I understand very well that itself, it's fine. But he can't even touch me. He can't touch me, so there can't be any of that physical bonding, and I just feel so emotionally removed, and it's putting a tremendous strain on the marriage. They come for a heter, you know, which I don't dispense. A man has to be particularly sensitive to this, that particularly during the period of Nida, when there's a physical separation, he has to be even more sensitive in his responses, in his conversations. Yes, there are certain types of conversation that are out of bounds during this period of time. But one shouldn't be so machmir in this. You know, I'll be so strict. I read some kind of kuntras from who knows where. You have to be strict about this and about this and about this. No. No, it's inappropriate. You have to be able to find things to talk about and to spend time together, even when she's needed. Or I should rephrase it, especially when she's needed. When she's not needed, it's the physical relationship. But when she is needed, since there is no physical relationship, that's to be even a greater emphasis on what we'll call the emotional relationship. Yes, not in a suggestive way, but rather in a more, how should I say, quote, non-romantic way, not in the sense of the romantic kinds of conversations which are really inappropriate to Anita, but the many other kinds of conversations. There are those who have interpreted the bracha we say at a wedding, Sameach Tesamach Reyem Ahuvim, that, you know, a husband and wife are supposed to be friends. Friends, not only in a physical sense, but friends that can communicate with each other even when there's no physical contact. And yes, I do believe in what recent experts have said, that one of the main problems in marriage today is communication, or the lack thereof. And communication, with words alone, is a very important skill, and we dare not lose it with respect to a spouse during the time of physical separation. Very, very, very important. This is something which everyone has to understand. Sometimes the man is, as I said before, is a little bit machmir. He doesn't want to do certain things which he feels he shouldn't do. And the woman is extraordinarily insulted. She thinks it's somehow it's an affront. Men should ask Shilas to find out what they may or may not do. And whoever's gone overboard and his chumris is really, he's being a tzaddik on someone else's cheshbon. It's really, you have to be very careful over here. Now, when a woman is pregnant with Hashem's help, what kind of other things happen? Some women throw up for 3 months, for who knows how many months. She sometimes feels a little bit low, she loses an appetite, and sometimes even the physical relationship changes. But to be careful. Sometimes women feel that when they become pregnant, they're less quote-unquote attractive. That's part of the mishigas of America. They have to be skinny, 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 skinny. By definition, if she has a baby, Baruch Hashem, she's not so skinny. Believe me, there are plenty of perennially skinny married women who would give anything to become a little bit fat when, quote-unquote, by becoming pregnant. You have to understand that she's also very concerned about the welfare of her unborn baby. And in a certain sense, the man becomes jealous. She's thinking about the baby more than she's thinking of me. The baby's not even born yet. So again, you have to be sensitive, you have to have empathy to know how she's feeling. Very, very, very important. And so too, when the baby is actually born, and the man sees that his whole romantic life is over. When there were only two of them, it was great. Now there's a third one who just steals all of her attention away from himself. Yes, the whole purpose of marriage, according to the Shulchan Aruch, Chayev Adam Lisa Isha, K'dei Lifros V'Lirbos, in order to have children, is exactly so. And the children will, in fact, take her away from him. And in some case, I hope, take him away from her when he's busy taking care of his children, which he has to do. And believe it or not, next week I want to start a new part of the series, which is, I guess, we'll call it parenting. Relationships between parents and children. We spoke about the first segment was children to parents, then men and women, husbands and wives. Now I want to talk about the responsibilities of parents towards their children, hopefully starting next week. A woman has the greater maternal instinct to take care of the children, which we spoke about a few weeks ago. And therefore, we have to understand that the husband has to realize this and not to be hurt or feel somehow insulted when the woman says to her husband, either overtly or indirectly, listen, I have to take care of the child and I'm putting you on hold. Okay, that's just the way it really is. And it should not be a source of marital strife. These are some of the distinctions between the nature of men and women, and we have to realize this. I don't think it's wise to be swept away by some of the modern notions of identity. At the same time, as we spoke about so many times, we do believe in equality. Equality, but not identity. This is the is the main point that we have to bring to bear in this area. Okay, these are some of the issues that we spoke about in this context. The last part of this sefer, which I'm going to speak a little bit about briefly, is anger. Now, anger, you'll say, what does it do with marriage? Anger is a problem throughout. You're right. Anger is a problem which transcends marriage. But it does have a very, very serious impact upon marriage. And Rabbi Feldman Shalita discusses the famous story of Hillel and the man who tried to anger him. He made a bet of 400 zuz. And he caught kind of an Erev Shabbos when he was in the shower and he came out. The whole story had some crazy questions. And he was very patient with him. He tried every means to anger Hillel. And Rav Feldman points out, as others before him have said, that anger is nothing more than the ultimate expression of gaiva. Gaiva. What does that mean? Do you know who I am? I'm an important personage. And therefore, if you don't treat me properly, I'm going to get angry. The really anger, he says, is based upon that. This man who tried to anger Hillel understood it very, very well. He also knew that in a pressurized time, we give in to anger more readily. So he walks in and he says, who's Hillel? Chutzpah. Hillel's the God of Ador. And he went, who's Hillel? Imagine a guy walk in I'll give an example to Rav Yashiv's house. Say, who's Rav Yashiv? Chutzpah. And then when did he come? Erev Shabbos in the afternoon. Oh, come on. The busiest time of the week, when so many pressures are upon the household. Then, he caught him when Hillel's hair was wet, in the middle of the shower. It's physically uncomfortable. Now, Hillel is doing a mitzvah, right? Preparing for Shabbos. A person who's doing a mitzvah has every right to get angry, right? Self-righteousness. I'm doing a mitzvah, and you are interrupting me. Okay. Finally, all this failed, then he decided to insult him directly. I have many questions to ask. I'm afraid you're going to become angry. Right? Then he says, are you Hillel, leader of the Jewish people? So Hillel said, yes. Then he said, then may there be no more like you in Israel. He still didn't get angry. Why? He said, listen, we have to try to keep calm and not to respond. So in this discussion, we talk about criticism. Criticism means, in some people's minds, an attack. I'm being criticized because I'm being attacked. And I have to respond. The primeval instinct of self-defense comes to the fore. Okay? So there are two ways to defend yourself from a criticism. The first is justification. I didn't do anything wrong. And the second, even more lethal, is counterattack. You're criticizing me. What do I have to say about you? And both are terrible, and particularly terrible in the context of a marriage. Okay? Let's say, for example, he gives the following case. A wife asks her husband to buy tomatoes on the way home. And he forgets. He comes home. She says, why'd you forget? Or she may say the worst word. You're always forgetting. The always word. He forgot once. Maybe he forgot last week. You're always forgetting. So he gets angry. So he may say, I was in a rush. You know, he finds some justification, which is not so bad. Worse is, true, I forgot. But last week, you forgot something much more important. Counterattack. Both are incorrect responses. The only response is to say, I'm wrong. This is my drush I gave last week in Yerushalayim or Kurdish. We spoke about it a little bit here in an earlier week. That the Targum says in last week's Parsha of Vayechi, Yehuda ati yaducha achecha, that Yehuda admitted to his mistake. That's it. He admitted. And because he admitted, that's why he was privileged that all of us are called Yehudim. Every Jew is called a Jew, which means a Yehudi, because of this tremendous admission by Yehuda. He could have given this excuse, that excuse, a counterattack. Who knows what he could have done? Just say, I'm wrong, I made a mistake, I forgot. This is something which is hard to do. Hard to do. I apologize. Finished. He quotes a chazal. If someone calls you a donkey, put a saddle on your back. Yeah, this is a Gemara Baba Kama. So what does it mean? The Vilna Gaon says, if someone says you have a fault, admit it, and it will stop talking about it. And that's a Gog in his parish on Nakamara says that. If you have a fault, so admit to it, that's all. Admit to it. This is the proper way to respond. Very, very important that we recognize this. This is very, very important. Now, we have to be careful not to stand on principle. Oh, it's a matter of principle. There's no greater principle than Shalom Bayis. If the Rebbe Osher was willing to have his name erased for Shalom Bayis, we can forego some of our quote principles which we will overlook anyway when we're in a jam for the sake of Shalom Bayis. And most important, as a subtitle he has over here, retaliation for past grievances. You are always doing these things to me. And sometimes an individual, when he's in an altercation, a spat with his wife, she'll bring up a story, you're not going to believe this, from 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, when this happened, you did this and this. 20 years ago, she never forgot it. It was always in the back of her brain. And if you start a fight, anything comes up. It's really very terrible. And we should be very, 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 very careful not to involve oneself in these kinds of discussion. And don't blame her for things. The first mistake of Adam HaRishon, after eating from the Eitz HaDa'as, was blaming his wife. The famous excuse, right? Ha'isha shenasata imodi. Says Rashi, Kan kofa betova. Hashem gave a man the most beautiful, precious present in the whole wide world, a wonderful wife, and as soon as he gets into a jam, he blames it all on her. That's no response. Rashi says it's a terrible, terrible thing. A terrible thing. And you have to be very careful about self-righteousness. You know, I have to do this because after all, the halacha says this, the halacha says that. There's a famous story which is told, it's told by different people, some Hasidic masters, about the following situation. A man had no esrog. Had no esrog. So, in his desperation to find money to buy an esrog, he sold an heirloom set of tefillin in order to buy the esrog. His wife knew he had no money. And he walks in Erev Sukkos with this beautiful esrog. She says, well, where did you come up with the money to buy the esrog? So he told her the truth. He sold the tefillin. You sold the tefillin? She takes it in a fit of rage and she throws it on the floor, and guess what? The pitman breaks. Now he has no tefillin. Now he has no esrog. And he's ready to his plots. Rabbanu Shalom, I have no tefillin. I have no esrog. But I'm not going to lose my cool. I'm not going to lose my dignity. I'm not going to respond with vehemence. The Baruch Shalom, this is your will. And we'll go into Sukkos without an esrog and without the tefillin. And we'll try to stay calm. That's a madriga. But that's what's required of all of us. Men and women. Men and women. So, how do you control anger? Go back to Hillel. If you have the humility of Hillel, who was a very, very humble person, you will almost never get angry. As we said before, Kas and Gaiva are related. As a matter of fact, if you look on the Rambam says that all midos you require what we call the golden mean. The golden mean. With one exception, he says. The exception is Gaiva, because it says Ma'od, Ma'od, Havei Shvaruach. Ma'od, Ma'od means to an extreme of humility. But another place, Rambam says, is another midah. They have to go to an extreme. And that's Kas. You should be very, very careful not to get angry at all. So the Mefarshim asked the question, there's a contradiction in the Rambam. The answer is, no, the two are related to each other. If a person will be very careful not to have any gaiva, automatically he will not become involved in kas. Kas is a reflection of gaiva. Because if you have a certain self-image, so you're not being treated in accordance with your self-image. That's what makes you angry. So we have to have a little bit of anava. Okay? He tells an amazing story. I don't think I could ever do this. Different.
No, you defend the other person.
That's different. That's, the person's not insulting you. The person's insulting someone else. You may have a requirement to rise to the defense of somebody else. But if it's you, it's not. This is an incredible story. That's an amazing story. Now, a sense of humor. Chazal say is an interesting pshat. A sense of humor, Chazal say, is even extends to Leit Sanus. Gemara says, Kol Leit Sanusa Asura, except for Leitzan of Avodah Zarah, to make fun of Avodah Zarah. Rabbi Feldman, in a very original thought, quotes a Gemara which says, that kolakoes kilo obed Avodah Zarah. If you get angry, it's like Avodah Zarah, and therefore he permits Leitzanus, making funny jokes, in order to prevent anger. He has this incredible story. He heard it himself. I once heard a wife call her husband a, quote, stupid idiot, in the presence of many guests. Shocked silence followed. No. Gewalt. But the husband removed the tension by pulling himself up to his full height in mock anger and saying, I resent that. I've been an idiot all my life. But this is the first time someone has implied that I'm stupid one to boot. End quote. They made a joke. The joke made everybody laugh. It also made everyone forget, and the wife to feel sorry for her nasty remark. Most important, though, to his humor, the husband deflated his own ego and sidetracked his anger. This is very, very important. And we have to have perspective. Say count to 10, right? Count to 10. But before counting to 10, you think, will this matter next week, next month, next year? Put it in perspective. Right now, it's a difficult moment. But don't respond that way. Don't respond that way. You have to be so careful. So careful. Now, we have to be melamed zchus. Give the other person the benefit of the doubt. It's very important. And, as we said before, I counted to 10. As a Hasidic rabbi used to dispense holy water, guaranteed to eliminate all domestic fights. Holy water, I thought it's from a different religion. Listen to this holy water. Whenever a husband or wife has an urge to argue, he or she was told to hold some of this water in his or her mouth without swallowing it for as long as he or she could. This holy water was not surprisingly extremely effective in stopping the squabble. That's more than counted to 10. You call it holy water, charge $10 an ounce, and then you stop somebody. That's all. It's interesting. He has Rabbi Feldman is very smart. He found out that a certain department store had a complaint department. And whenever she was trained, the complaint department would ask the caller, he would kindly repeat what he said because she didn't get it straight the first time. The caller would, of course, repeat his complaint, but would usually tone down his anger appreciably the second time around. The next step was to transfer his call to another operator who would ask him to repeat his complaint for the third time. By this time, the caller had lost most of his heat, and the apology offered by the telephone operator was generally accepted. So delay weakens anger. Hearing oneself but getting angry makes one feel a little silly. It's a good trick. It's a good trick. Now, this is something, Andy, which is very, very important. couples should never argue publicly. If you have a dispute, no one should hear it. No one should hear it. Very, very important. Very. Manerach Yoshev Chema. Speak softly. If you have to be upset, no one outside the home should hear it. I heard a story, I think, about my Waxman tape recently. The Chazon Ish was once walking up the steps of someone's house in Bnei Brak, and he heard this husband and wife screaming, yelling at each other. He ran down the stairs as fast as he could. He didn't want anyone to... He didn't want to be there when this person was in a difficult moment. So don't give people an opportunity to hear, I don't know what they say, pots and pans flying or doors slamming or whatever other makes a lot of noise in such a marital spat. It's very serious. Remember, don't ever use words that you regret. I have cases where people come to me. My husband used the D word, the divorce. I'll divorce you. That is a terrible word to use. Terrible, terrible, terrible word. She'll never forget it. This could undo a marriage forever. There's always in the back of her mind, 20 years later, she can remember he once used that word. Just don't. Don't use the word always. Stick to an issue. Don't bring up the old stuff from 20 years ago. And don't bring in the relatives. You're just like your mother. That's a bad way. A bad way. And always be ready to compromise. Always apologize. The best thing is to say, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. Finished. I made a mistake. Now, we do make mistakes. And there's no one who will not make mistakes. But getting angry is the worst mistake of all. The Gemara is Masechta Shabbos. Ragzon ein lo ela ragzanuse. The person who gets angry has nothing but anger. That's it. Nothing but you don't accomplish anything with anger. Nothing. Gemara, excuse me, in Masechta Kiddushin. Nothing. You have to do your best to avoid anger at all costs. And a person who is prideful is not even acceptable to his own wife, because pride and anger prevent a proper marriage from emerging. To summarize, therefore, anger is something which is bad in life and even worse in marriage. We have to work on ourselves. It's a lifetime project to work on this, because anger is a natural instinct. We all have some of it in ourselves. We have to try our best to eliminate this anger from ourselves in order to better our marriages. And I will just conclude with one last point, which is the chapter on gratitude. Gives an example. It's full of beautiful examples. Quote, a guy comes to him from Kolonik. His wife was extremely negligent in caring for the home. Instead of washing the dishes and straightening up the kitchen after supper, she would sink into a sofa for the rest of the evening and read a book. Oh, no good, Nick. So I asked the wife, it's true. She also said she worked 12 hours a day on two jobs to support her husband's study in the Kolonik, and was pregnant besides. By the time she finished dinner, she had no strength left. This husband is an ingrate. It's an ingrate. They don't understand what their wives are doing for them. Terrible. Goes back to the beginning. Adam was an ingrate, as I said, with respect to Chava, and blamed it on his wife. So therefore, gratitude is critical. It's critical. A person who's not grateful to a human being will not be grateful to Hashem. Again, this week's parsha, that's coming up parsha. Moshe was told, don't hit the water, don't hit the ground, because they saved you. Now, water and ground have no feelings. It's to inculcate within ourselves the idea of Hakaras HaTov. And how do you avoid gratitude? We forget what people did for us. Or we attribute selfish motives to the benefactor. Right? She worked 12 hours a day. Yeah. It's her duty to support Torah. I'm the Kerlinik, and she's not. She's just a. She's not doing anything out of the special. That's her job to support a Kerlinik. I mean, are you crazy? You lost your marbles. By strict halacha, you should be going. You should be working 12 hours a day, and she should be sitting pretty at home. That's what the halacha says. That's what the ksuba says. She wants to be a tzedekis and work 12 hours, and you're complaining that she's tired after supper. This man needs a reality check. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. For example, Moshe Rabbeinu was grateful to Yisrael. Right? Why? He opened his home to him. Wait a minute. He had an ulterior motive, which was realized in this week's parasha, that Moshe should marry one of his daughters. Doesn't make a difference. I told you the story of Rab Chia. Rab Chia, his wife was a shrew. He asked for bean soup, she gave him barley soup, and the other way around. And once his children flipped it, so she got the right thing. And she said to them, what do you do over here? They said, Abba, you know, Ima's always flipping on you. No, Dayenu, Shemegadlos Esponenu, Matzilos Nosem Menachet. You have to have gratitude even to a wife who does not do things that you ask. So it's exactly the reverse, because of their raising the children and preventing the husband from sinning, etc. We have to have such a tremendous hakaras hatov to a wife. And again, this book is written for men, but at the same time, it applies to women as well. This is something which is critical. If you have this gratitude, and you express the gratitude, you express it. Always say thank you. You say thank you to the person, to the stranger in the store, and you don't say thank you to your wife. Well, she's like me, ishta kagufo. That's a mistake. Always say thank you. Always say thank you. This is important to express gratitude. I believe that individuals who study these lessons that we're grateful to this wonderful author, Rav Feldman, Moshe Shiva of Ner Yisrael. There are other svarim that I recommend by Rabbi Volbe of Zichron Levracha of Bar Yaakov, and Rabbi Friedlander of Ponovich. Those are two other wonderful svarim on these topics, and there are many others. But this is my favorite because it gets right under your skin. Very, very, very perceptive and very articulate in its presentation. I recommend that everybody has it in the house, read it, reread it, and try to implement it. It's my tefillah that all those who will do their best to achieve this high level of shalom bayis, remember the river, the kettle, and the bird being the highest level, will be zocha to do so. And just as we introduce shalom into our own homes, we should have shalom on Yisrael. So the Mefarshim suggests, the Pasuk says, "He shalom bechelech shalva v'amen osayich." Chelech may refer to the army, chayil. We pray for peace for the army fighting now in Gaza, but the way we can somehow achieve it is by putting shalva v'amen osayich in our own palace, our own homes. If we have greater shalom bayis in our own homes, the Kodesh Baruch Hu will respond not only by blessing us in our homes, but by blessing our chayalim, by blessing our people in Eretz Yisrael, and giving us the true peace. And this is the finale on the famous pasuk Perek and Tilla that we said just tonight. That is often sung at a chuppah in certain communities. The famous Shir HaMalos. We talk about Esh Tzchok Yaf and Poria, all that stuff. And we say at the very end of the perek, Urevanu Levanecha Shalom Al Yisrael. So perhaps that's the pshat. If the couple will have marital bliss and raise their children properly, what we call Shalom Abba Nosayach, there'll be Shalom Bechelech Shalom Al Yisrael in its truest sense. And ultimately, in the real sense of the Gula Shlem of Meher V'Yameinu Amen.